Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Russia. As usual, I'm Damon, and this is episode 75, An Ambassador Calls. Thanks for listening in. Okay, so last time out we took a break from the main narrative and looked instead at some of the other things, a spot of palace building, Siberian expansion, the plight of the serfs, and the minimalist form of enlightenment that were all going on in the Russian Empire circa 1750. This week we'll be covering just the two main items, the Empress Elizabeth's ongoing and so far frustrated efforts to secure the Romanov succession, and the political machinations and intrigues that would eventually lead to the outbreak of the Seven Years' War. Never sure if that's machinations or machinations, but anyway, that's what we'll be discussing. Now, on the surface, that all sounds nice and straightforward, but, dear listeners, this is Russia, where even the past is unpredictable and where nothing seems to go quite to plan. And unfortunately for us, both of this week's agenda items will fit that particular bill. Oh, and finally, and as indicated by the title, there is someone from outside of Russia, who gets to play quite an important and intriguing role in our proceedings. But before we get to all of that, just a quick reminder that this podcast is supported by the kind and generous members of the Boyar Duma, and a warm welcome to Tanya, who's recently joined the fold. If you want to join them to get ad-free content, members-only episodes, early access to general release episodes, and written transcripts, for around the price of a cup of coffee a month, then you can by subscribing to the Boyar Duma via Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And, as always, check the episode notes for the details and links. And incidentally, for the members-only episodes, I'm currently running two concurrent mini-series. One is all about famous Russian authors, and the other is on the life and times of none other than Grigory Rasputin. Okay, if you're all set, let's do some history of Russia. And we'll start with the current situation regarding the Romanov dynasty. If we take a glimpse back over the past 28 years, starting in 1725, the succession to the Russian throne had been anything but straightforward and predictable. Since the death of Peter the Great, there had been five different rulers. Peter was followed by his second wife, Catherine, or Catherine I, and she in turn was succeeded by Peter's grandson, Peter II. But for most of that time, Alexander Menshikov was pulling the strings. Then we had Anna Ivanovna, the daughter of Peter the Great's half-brother Ivan V, who was followed by the infant Tsar Ivan VI, and the two regency regimes, and then finally we've got Peter the Great's daughter, Elizabeth. And in all that time there had only been two reigns of any length, Anna Ivanovna's 10 years and to date Elizabeth's 12 years. But it's only really been in the latter period where Russia has experienced anything approaching long-term stability. Having said that, Anna, in her own way, did try her best, but as we've seen, it all ended in tears. But whilst with hindsight we can take that overall view, Elizabeth in 1753 herself was far from satisfied with the current situation regarding who was next in line and who would come after that. Next in line was, of course, Peter the Great's other grandson, my friend and yours, Peter Manboy Fyodorovich. But after Peter, who knew? And Elizabeth's fears, based on those past 25 years, were that nothing regarding the succession was cast in stone. Anything could happen. Perhaps a foreign invasion, or more likely, some kind of internal coup, could topple the dynasty. And remember that in the far north of Russia, up in Kolmogory, there happened to be a certain 12-year-old lad, the ex-Tsar and Romanov, Ivan VI, the son of Anna Ivanovna's niece, Anna Leopoldovna. And in 1753, he was still imprisoned, with only his jailer for company. But maybe in time, he could, or would, become the focal point for some kind of insurrection. Elizabeth's prompting, urging, planning and hoping that Peter and Catherine would strengthen the Petrine Romanov line had to this point been of no avail. But coupled with this, she had been determined that there would be no visible sight or sign or memory of the prisoner in Kolmogory. No one ever mentioned him, at least not in Elizabeth's company they didn't, and any coins, official documents and edicts that had either been minted or written in his name during his brief reign were gathered up or confiscated and then destroyed. And by the way, if you happen to have an Ivan VI coin in your collection, lucky you. They're very scarce, with some of the very rare examples fetching in excess of $300,000 at auction. Yes, things would be a lot simpler for the Empress if he simply wasn't there, or if he died from some kind of Putin-style accident. But holding true to her own edict that there would be no state-sponsored executions on her watch, he was left, for the time being, where he was, out of sight and almost out of mind. For the here and now, however, all Elizabeth could do was carry on fretting and hoping that Peter and Catherine would provide the answer to her prayers by providing her and Russia with a healthy male Romanov. And at least over the past 18 months, there had been some activity on that front. Okay, the outcomes, the two miscarriages suffered by Catherine and her semi-clandestine affair with Sergei Soltikov weren't ideal, but at least things did seem to be slowly moving in the right direction. However, in early 1753, Catherine had started to notice that Sergei's attention had, little by little, started to wane. When she pressed him on this, he told her that his feelings for her were still the same, but that they needed to be extremely cautious. Too many people knew or had guessed that something was going on between them, and if their secret became more widely known, then who could tell what would happen? Soltikov then added that to protect themselves from any eventual outcome, they would need to do two things. One, get some political protection or insurance, and two, advance his own position at court. Catherine, reassured that his feelings remained true, said that she would see what she could do. But in reality, what options did she have? Trying to get her husband's help would be difficult for a number of reasons, and she quickly ruled out involving Peter in any shape or form. The more she thought about it, the more she realised there was only one option open to her. It would be difficult, and she would have to tread carefully. But fortune favours the brave, so I'm told, and so she decided to take her chances with none other than the Grand Chancellor himself. Catherine's initial step was to send a note to Bestuzhev, who was now a 60-year-old seasoned veteran of Russian court politics, explaining that despite their previous differences, she hoped that now and in the future they could let bygones be bygones and enjoy a warmer political relationship. And to her surprise, she quickly received a reply from the Chancellor stating that he was receptive to such a move. Bestuzhev then received a social call from an impatient Soltikov, who outlined his political hopes and ambitions. The Chancellor listened intently, and then over the next couple of hours, he provided the younger man with his wealth of experience and some advice as to how to negotiate the swirling currents of the Russian court, who was in with who to talk to, who not to talk to, and most importantly, who to trust. He also advised Soltikov to be patient, bide his time, and not to get on the wrong side of either the Shuvalovs or, most importantly, the Empress. And it's this last piece of advice that provides the clue as to why Bestuzhev had reacted so warmly to Catherine and Sergei's overtures. Bestuzhev could see the way the wind was blowing. Ivan Shuvalov was by now entrenched as Elizabeth's lover and favourite, and whilst he wasn't particularly ambitious, his elder cousins, Alexander and Pyotr, were, and they were both using their influence to massively enrich and empower themselves. Coupled with this, the Empress's health was a growing concern. Whenever she was ill, which was often, she was taking longer and longer to recover. What would happen if she were to die? If or when Peter took over, his pro-French and pro-Prussian leanings would doubtlessly impact Bestuzhev's overall foreign policy strategy, which, as we know, was pro-British and anti-Prussian and anti-French. And so Catherine's letter and Sergei Soltikov's visit came at the same time that Bestuzhev himself was looking around for potential new alliances. Apart from Catherine's second miscarriage in the early summer and the outbreak of several serious fires in Moscow, where the court happened to be at the time, and which destroyed one of the royal palaces along with a large number of Catherine's books, nothing else of great importance happened during 1753. There was no news of any advancement for Soltikov, and the Choglikovs, yes, they were still on the scene, and even though they were less of a threat and were more tractable and less hostile, their very presence still made Catherine in particular feel a sense of unease. But in the winter and spring of 1754, all of this ennui and restlessness was broken, first with the news that in February Catherine was pregnant again, and then secondly in April that Choglikov had died, and that subsequently his wife, Madame Choglikova, had been retired from her position at court. The Empress decided that the Choglikovs were to be replaced by Alexander Shuvalov and his wife, a move that Bestuzhev was unable to prevent. And as for the pregnancy, well, this time there was to be no miscarriage. And as spring turned to summer, plans were in full swing for the birth of a new, hopefully male, Romanov. And then eventually, on the 1st of October, or the 20th of September in the old-style calendar, Elizabeth's expectations and prayers were finally met with the birth of a healthy male child. But if Catherine now thought that her life was going to get better, and that the pressure and frustration of the last decade were going to be things of the past, she would have to think again. No sooner than her son had been born, he was whisked away from her side, to be cared for in the Empress's apartments by nursemaids and servants that Elizabeth herself had appointed. Pavel Petrovich Romanov, Elizabeth had him named and christened Pavel, as this had been the name of the first male child born to her parents, was first and foremost a child of the Russian state. Catherine's needs and personal feelings were a distant second. For the first 5 days, she didn't see her son at all, and on the sixth day, the day of his christening, she was only able to look at him from a distance. As a reward for her services, Catherine received, via Elizabeth, a gift of 100,000 rubles from the Russian treasury. Now, this money was going to be more than handy, as over the past few years, she'd run up significant debts. However, a few days later, she received a note from the treasury asking politely for the money back, because apparently Elizabeth needed it for other things. And later in October, Sergei Soltikov received his award. He was appointed as a special envoy to the Royal Court of Sweden, and so he departed to Stockholm, leaving Catherine feeling even more alone. 40 days after the birth, Catherine's period of official confinement came to an end, and while she was allowed to briefly see her young son again, soon after the ceremony ended, she found herself practically penniless and isolated in her own rooms. So, was Soltikov's move down to Bestuzhev's influence, or was he being quietly shuffled off to one side, i.e. was the massive elephant in the room now to be the smaller elephant in Stockholm? We don't know. Neither do we definitively know who young Pavel's father was. As I said a couple of episodes ago, the smart money was on Soltikov, and Catherine herself certainly thought that was the case. However, as Pavel, or Paul as he would become known in the West, grew up, everyone commented on how much he resembled Peter, both physically and in character and manner. Anyway, whatever had happened, Paul was now effectively being brought up as Elizabeth's child, and Catherine was left alone and depressed, without her lover or her son by her side. Peter was still around, of course, but even he stayed away from her, preferring instead the company of his useless drone-like drunken friends, and so Catherine now spent nearly all of her time preoccupied with two main things, reading and thinking. But we'll find out just what she was reading and what she was thinking about after a short.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Break. Okay, we're back.
As mentioned previously, a number of Catherine's books and possessions had been destroyed by the fire in Moscow, but now that she was back in St. Petersburg, she had access to an impressive collection of literature, and the works she chose to immerse herself in her depressed seclusion were those by the Roman historian Tacitus and the French philosophers and thinkers Voltaire and Montesquieu. Voltaire proved to be a favourite, mainly because he had the knack of explaining deep philosophical subjects with simplicity and humour, and it was his works in particular that were to form the basis of her own mindset and ideology, most notably when it came to the virtues and benefits of the enlightened, despotic form of government that Voltaire espoused. And when she wasn't reading, her mind turned to thoughts of her son Paul, her lover Sergei Soltikov, and in general to what the future would bring. Paul was now the property of the Russian state. She hardly ever saw him, and her maternal feelings for him gradually started to seep away. But she also realised again, gradually, that her son had been effectively kidnapped by Elizabeth, who was now bringing up Paul as her own son, which had perhaps been her plan all along. Word eventually reached Catherine that Soltikov's diplomatic visit to Sweden had been a triumph, that whilst there, he'd had many affairs. She also found out that when he returned from Stockholm, rather than staying in St. Petersburg, he would be taking up the position of Russia's resident ambassador in Hamburg. So effectively childless and loveless, she began to realise that for the best part of the last decade, she'd been used, or more to the point, she had let herself be used. And so during late 1754 and early 1755, as her depression started to fade, new thoughts entered her mind, and she resolved that from now on, she wasn't going to appease anyone. It was time to start forging her own destiny, and her useless husband, the Empress, and everyone else at court could either like it or lump it. And first in the firing line were the Shuvalovs. Alexander Shuvalov, Elizabeth's secret police head, and his wife were proving to be even more burdensome than the Troglikovs. They took their role as watchdogs over Catherine and Peter seriously and were always questioning the young couple's decisions, actions, and opinions. Peter didn't seem to mind them and just carried on in his own strange way. And anyway, he was preoccupied with matters concerning his Duchy of Holstein. Catherine couldn't stand them. On February 21st, she made her official re-entrance into court society at a ball which was arranged to celebrate Peter's 27th birthday, and from that point on, she resolved to fight her corner. Whenever one of the Shuvalovs or their entourage made a negative statement or a disparaging remark, she would hit back with caustic words of her own. And when Alexander Shuvalov tried to get Peter involved, saying something along the lines of, "Sort your wife out," she told her husband in no uncertain terms that she was doing nothing wrong and that he should stop meddling in her affairs and back off. On the surface, this was hardly earth-shattering stuff, but Catherine's new forthright attitude and character had the desired effect. She was in her prime and the mother of a future Tsar, and her enemies and her husband were caught off balance, and they now had to think twice before taking her on. And Elizabeth, well, seemingly, she was either too ill or too preoccupied with baby Paul to either notice or interfere. In June 1755, at another St. Petersburg ball, a newly confident, almost glowing Catherine was introduced to two men who would go on to have a temporary yet significant impact upon her life. And the first of these was the newly appointed British ambassador, Sir Charles Hanbury Williams. The 47-year-old Hanbury Williams ticked all the right boxes that were required for his role. He was rich and influential, had been educated at Eton, was a serving MP, and he was worldly wise, urbane, witty, and sophisticated. Catherine, who was now aged 26, found herself placed next to Hanbury Williams at the supper that accompanied the ball. Now, whether this was by chance, or the two had been purposely placed next to each other, something that could have been engineered by Bestuzhev, we don't know. Anyhow, the two of them had a series of mutually interesting conversations, which were mainly centred on his diplomatic experience and the different and numerous European capitals that he had visited. And then later, in the same evening, Hanbury Williams introduced Catherine to a young Polish nobleman, the 23-year-old Count Stanislaus Poniatowski, who was currently acting as secretary to the older man. And to cut a long story very short, the new British ambassador was to become a good friend, and a kind of father figure to Catherine, while the Polish count was to become her lover. By all accounts, Poniatowski, or Poniatowski, was not the handsomest of men. He was short, short-sighted, and, well, a little odd-looking. However, he made up for these disadvantages by being well-educated, cultured, sophisticated, and politically connected. He could speak six languages, was a member of one of Poland's most distinguished families, had read the works of Voltaire, and was the very essence of an enlightened aristocrat. Catherine was intrigued, and as the summer progressed and the two of them found themselves more and more in each other's company, Catherine found herself increasingly drawn to young Stanislaus. And again, and to cut another long story short, the two of them would become lovers, but the relationship that we are going to concentrate on here was the one between Catherine and the British ambassador. But before we do that, we need to explore why Hanbury Williams was in St. Petersburg in the first place, and what he was hoping to achieve whilst he was there. Okay, so the current British king, George II, like his father, George I, much preferred Hanover to Great Britain, and would spend as much time as possible in his German electorate, mainly because in Hanover he ruled, whereas in Britain it was Parliament that in reality called the shots. And also, like his father before him, George II was generally preoccupied with Hanover's safety and security, and in particular the threat posed by Frederick the Great's expansionist policies. The Prussian king had taken Silesia during the War of the Austrian Succession, and George was worried that if another conflict came, and all the signs were that it would, then Hanover too could be seized and occupied. So what Britain and Hanover needed was an alliance or some kind of agreement with one of the other European powers to help keep Frederick in check. Now, Britain and Russia had signed an agreement back in 1742, which went something along the lines of, we'll pay you some cash, and if we, or importantly, one of our territories, i.e. Hanover, are attacked, then you will help us out militarily, i.e. you'll go to war with Prussia. In 1755, this agreement, which had never been required to be enforced or acted upon, was due to expire. However, the resident British representative in Russia, the impressively named Melchior Guy Dickens, had been unable to make any headway negotiating an extension. And so the British government, at the urging of George II, decided to dispatch the more nuanced and experienced Hanbury Williams to get the job done. And upon his arrival, Hanbury Williams had hit the ground running. He'd made all the right ministerial connections, and then via those connections, he ensured that he was seen and heard by those who moved in the very top circles of Russian society. He worked out who he thought he could trust, Bestuzhev and maybe Elizabeth, and who he thought he couldn't, the Shuvalovs and Peter. But whilst Bestuzhev and Elizabeth listened and smiled and nodded in all the right places, no decision regarding the agreement extension was forthcoming, and growing increasingly frustrated, he communicated his concerns and lack of progress back to London. The only piece of positive news that he was able to write about was that regarding his increasingly close, yet strictly platonic relationship with Catherine. Since their introduction to one another in June 1755, Catherine and Hanbury Williams had continued to discuss a whole range of subjects, sometimes in person, but more often via letters. They talked about philosophy, European politics, the cultural differences between Russia and Great Britain, and most importantly, Catherine's views on the Russian court. And from these many stimulating conversations and pieces of correspondence, Hanbury Williams was able to build a picture of what Catherine's life had been like, how intelligent she was, and how she was now utilising her recently discovered inner strength and confidence. And as the weeks passed, their trust in one another grew. However, for the British ambassador, the relationship with the Grand Duchess potentially represented much more than just light-hearted conversations, polite philosophical discourse, and secret correspondence. Hanbury Williams hoped that the friendship would enhance Britain's position, and in the weeks ahead, perhaps Catherine, either via Bestuzhev or maybe even directly with Elizabeth, could help get the British money for Russian guns agreement across the line. And he thought he knew how he could speed things up. He'd found out that Catherine's spending was out of control and that she had significant debts. And so with agreement from London, he casually dropped into a conversation that if Catherine ever needed any financial assistance, all she had to do was ask. Now, Catherine knew that accepting money from Hanbury Williams was dangerous. She wasn't stupid, and she knew that she would be being paid, in reality, by the British government in exchange for her using her influence. However, she also knew that the same game was being played by everyone at the Russian court, and that throughout the palaces of Europe, this kind of corrupt behaviour was also commonplace. Yes, the newly confident Catherine thought, why not? Everything would be okay, no one would find out, and on the plus side, she could really do with the money, and so she accepted. We don't know how much money she received. Official receipts show that at least 50,000 rubles was paid out, but the total amount was likely to have been much higher. Also, we don't know if it was Catherine's influence in particular that paid dividends. All we do know is that in September 1755, the extension to the agreement between Russia and Great Britain was signed by Bestuzhev. For an annual payment of £100,000, Russia would station 50,000 troops near Prussia's eastern border, a clear warning to Frederick that the rest of Germany, and Hanover in particular, was not to be messed with. Hanbury Williams and Bestuzhev were both happy with the revised agreement. Hanbury Williams was reported to be ecstatic. However, if they thought that this was going to be an end to the matter, they couldn't have been more wrong. And that was because the European diplomatic scene, with its system of intertwined and established alliances, was about to be turned on its head. But to find out exactly how this happened and the impact that it would have, you'll have to join me next time, because for today, dear patrons and listeners, we are done. In the meantime, keep fighting the good fight, look after yourselves, and stay very, very safe.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.